Hi everyone, this is Chander in Palo Alto, and you're listening to Valley Nordic, a podcast about business, technology, and culture from Silicon Valley and Nordic perspective.
Yeah, and hi, I'm in Arne in Oslo, and I'm on the same podcast.
Yes, if you're new to the podcast, it's conversations between Arne, who's a venture capitalist, and me, who is an entrepreneur, so you get to hear both sides of the world, people who build things and people who invest in things. Today's topic is something I think we first talked about in 2019 when we discussed 20 trends to observe in 2020, and one of them was space tech. And I think since then, so much has happened in that space. It's super exciting. Now, I wish I had done more homework in reading, studying the space, but it's fascinating what's happening. So we'll talk about space tech. We'll cover mainly how to think about that market. You know, what are the categories of investment and what's happening? And then what's driving that? Like, why is this happening now? You have anything to add to that, Arne? Arne will, of course, talk about money, where the money is going and what are the valuations. And I think he will share a tidbit about SPAC's connection to space.
Yep. Sounds good. Let's go for it.
Okay. So space, you know, I think all engineers, both Arne and I are engineers, love space. I don't know why. I think all engineers love space. I remember watching Star Trek as a kid, and then following, you know, the history of NASA and creation of NASA. And a lot of things come, a lot of tech came out of the US and Russian space program. I may be mixing it, but I think the transistor, which is foundation of tech now, was influenced by the space program somehow. I forget the connection. Do you remember, Arne?
No, I don't remember, but you know, I guess both of us are sort of old enough, and you know, back in the day, space was like the far end of what you could dream about for computer games and everything. So like in the 60s, it was the Apollo program, reaching the moon. And, you know, growing up in the 80s, you know, the space shuttle program and everything was really top of mind and the big, big events. And then sort of space was a little bit gone from the sort of top of the agenda for a number of years. And, you know, particularly in the US, the space shuttle program got canceled or stopped or so forth. So obviously there's been people in space with the International Space Station and so forth, but it hasn't been top of mind, and yet now it's sort of a hot space again.
Yeah, and US now has a space force, you know, fourth arm of military. And I think a lot of other governments are spending money on space. So we are glad it's hot. And my thinking is like, you know, just developing technologies for space inspired a lot of tech on the ground, you know, communication, semiconductor, same thing might happen with the new space race that's happening now.
Exactly. And in that context, obviously China investing in this sort of creates a new competitive situation, I guess. And also the fact that I guess what you know, the Apollo program was obviously in the US side of things was very successful, but as the space shuttle program turned out to be a very, very expensive program that got more and more expensive and yet maybe not yielded quite as much results as hoped, NASA has now changed the model quite a lot, where essentially it's a buyer and a contractor and a funding source, but using you know, private enterprise and entrepreneurship as a way to be innovative on a more cost-efficient or more output-oriented way of doing it. And that's why there's also multiple companies coming up and racing for these contracts there and iterating quite rapidly.
Yeah, and I think both you and I do government bashing, but I think NASA is pretty cool, very innovative on how they operate. And, you know, all the bad labs, it's like internet, ARPANET, DARPA, a lot of the cool stuff we use initially came out of government. I think it varies by the agency. Some are efficient and effective, some are not.
I think, you know, government has a role to play in, you know, the long-term development of countries and economy and so forth, and can think more long-term. But it's all about how you allocate money and how you incentivize and finding efficient ways of running things, even under government umbrella. And sometimes it succeeds well and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, and they can take the risk.
yeah.
On the other hand, a VC like you has less appetite for risk.
It depends. It's different kinds of risk. But a VC does not have risk appetite in 20 years time frame.
Yeah, that's what I meant. You have to show returns in, let's say, 10 years or so.
Yeah, less preferably. But yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about how to think about space. So I, you know, when I was preparing for the podcast today, I saw a classification by a private equity firm, which is investing in space, which I found fascinating. A PE firm is investing. And as Arne said, the, you know, VCs have a 10-year horizon, and a lot of these space things are unproven and need a lot of capital, and the time horizon for return may be beyond 10 years. So that's why you see more SPACs in that area, and more PE money or alternate money to VCs, but depends which one. So broadly, I think we can divide what's happening in space into our space tech into three categories. The first is launch business, like you're launching things into space. Like you may be sending people to the space station like SpaceX is doing. You may be sending stuff for them. You may be sending, you know, robots or rovers to Mars, basically launching things into space.
And satellites into orbit, not least.
Yeah, satellites, of course, and then there's space tourism. So there are many examples in that, so many applications in that space, but the business they are in is, you know, and the technologies they're developing are related to launch. So SpaceX is one example, it's Elon Musk company, Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos' company, Virgin Galactic, which is Richard Branson company. They're all launching things, things or people into space.
There's also Virgin Orbit.
Yes. What's the difference in Virgin Galactic and Virgin Orbit?
So Virgin Galactic is actually a space tourism company, mm-hmm. whereas Virgin Orbit has a launcher to launch things into orbit, i.e. satellites and so forth, mm-hmm. from an airborne platform. So a big plane with a launcher that takes things into orbit.
Okay. Yeah, I remember. Yeah, that's cool. So this is, I think, high capital area, like a lot of money. And I think this area is mainly dominated by SpaceX and Blue Origin, because, you know, the founders have unlimited money and patience to make it happen.
And government's programs in other parts of the world also launch.
Yep. Yeah. And China, do you see any like VC money going in that space, Arne, or in this category?
Yes, there is. I mean, you can define SpaceX as having VC backed. So, I mean, it does happen, but it's peculiar kind of VC, and the money is so big. So this is not your, you know, average VC doing so. And there's also a lot of historically has been sovereign wealth money going into this.
Yeah. You had a fun fact related to SPACs and space. You want to share that?
Yeah. So Virgin Galactic is, you know, the Virgin's space tourism company is actually a listed company, and it got listed by doing a SPAC back in 2019. We've talked about SPACs on this podcast. It's been, let's call it the rage the last year plus, although it's been a little bit of a bumpy ride at the same time, but it certainly has been a trend. And this is Virgin Galactic was SPAC'd by Chamath Palihapitiya. I apologize, I probably can't say the name wrong.
No, you said it well. That's good, Arne.
it's to a Norwegian, it's a very complicated name. But he's a well-known player in, let's call it VCs. Originally, he was a Facebook executive who started Social Capital, pretty high profile, moved about, and has become sort of, I think, the pioneer, I would say, in the tech world doing SPACs and sort of starting the SPAC trend, or at least one of the pioneers. And this was his first SPAC. So that's, it's kind of pioneering in itself, and that pioneering happening in space domain.
Yeah. Yeah. And
so Virgin Galactic is actually a listed company that you can follow on the New York Stock Exchange, and it's a company that's currently valued at $10.5 billion.
Wow. Yeah, high risk, you know.
The last 12 months the revenues of the company were $238,000. So the price sales of this company is rather high, I would say.
And the revenue is the advanced tickets they have sold to people to take them to space.
I'm not sure how they account for grant revenue. There's, you know, grants are an important funding source, although I would assume that it, you know, the grants do not add up on the revenue side, although government contracts can. But the essentially the operating expenses for the last year was $275 million dollars. So it's a burner.
Yeah. And do you see more? I think a lot more SPACs are happening in space world. Do you know of others?
Yeah, I can't remember the names. There are lesser known companies and multiple of them that's been SPAC'd in the space tech. I mean, you know, some of the space startups need a lot of cash, and it's not one of these, you know, you grow revenue aggressively by acquiring customers like where the sort of the main action in the VC world is in this day. You know, I think the capital allocation or the capital need and the time frame of that doesn't fit greatly into the traditional VC model. Of course, it's also problematic, I think, over the long term to have you know, listed companies with unpredictable revenues and time frames. So, you know, I don't know whether the SPAC is actually becoming a listed company is actually a very good model for this, but clearly through this time period of the last couple of years, there has been opportunities to raise funding that way.
Yeah, and to refresh people's memories, SPAC is special purpose acquisition company. So it's kind of a reverse merger. So in the Virgin Galactic's case, you know, Chamath had a listed company, or Chamath's company bought Virgin Galactic and then listed that on the stock exchange. So the money that the company gets is from like a private investor, and then they generate additional money from the, or sell part of the equity in the public market.
Yeah. It's essentially a listed blank check company that buys an operating company. Yeah. And through that process, it becomes a listed company.
Yeah. Okay, so we see the first part in space is the launch business. Second is the Earth observation and communication business, where companies that are building the satellites for observation of Earth, like imagery, or their different business models there. They may sell images to hedge funds, to agriculture companies, in case of observation. In case of communication, it's the internet. I think the biggest example is Starlink, which is also a SpaceLink program. Not SpaceLink, SpaceX program. Another example is Planet Labs. I think this was started way back in like 2010, I think, where they were sending like cell phones, using cell phones or satellites, smartphones or satellites, for taking images. And I don't know where, I think they're doing well, but they may have a business model of selling imagery as a SaaS business to other companies.
Yes, there's a multitude of company. I mean, operating a communications network that's reliable, kind of like Starlink, that's a major enterprise. Building micro or nano satellites and having them gather data is something that's a trend in volume, and it doesn't have to be that major operation because of SpaceX and operations like that. Launching satellites has become much, much cheaper, and you can launch much more of them. Mm-hmm. And building these satellites, you know, uses the latest technology that's being developed for other consumer purposes and so forth. So building and operating a network, gathering data, images or other forms of data from space, it's a very good vantage point for a number of things. And, you know, having more data and crunching data is sort of one of the main trends in the market today as well. So the whole sort of observe and crunch data model is very much timely and cost effective these days.
Yeah, I remember when I was, I don't remember much from my MBA, but this I remember I had to write a paper on Iridium, which was one of the first efforts by Motorola to create this satellite network around Earth. And I was so excited about it. And I was doing internship at a company called Nortel. People may not know who are young or younger. They were a Canadian telecom equipment company, like, you know, Cisco or Ericsson. And I had a meeting with the president of the company. He was meeting all interns, and I was like, you know, upset with him. Why is Nortel not building something related to satellite? But that didn't work out for various reasons. That's a topic for another podcast.
Comparison, I believe, I can't remember the exact configuration and how far away from Earth the Iridium satellites were. But if I remember correctly, Iridium was a system of 55 or 77 or something like that satellites. So below 100, but still in the tens of satellites. Mm-hmm. And it was primarily a voice channel, where I believe it was compressed into 2.2 2.6 or 2.8 kilobits per second or something like that. And you had a text messaging service with it. And compare that to Starlink today, it's a very low, you know, lots of satellites at low altitude. Typically like 50 megabits per second, low latency data, and thousands of satellites.
Yeah. So I think we should mention, all right, for people have why this in specific here, the excitement is around low Earth orbit satellites. And I think to understand that there are basically three layers or orbits around Earth where satellites are. First is called GEO, that geosynchronous equatorial orbit. So that's around 22,000 miles away from Earth, 22,000 miles. And in that orbit, they were the first ones. The first satellites we sent up for communication were GEO, we meaning human beings, not Arne and I. And so they rotate around the Earth in 24 hours. So they follow Earth's velocity. So they appear stationary because they move at the speed of Earth. And you need basically three of them to cover all of Earth.
Except from the North Pole and South Pole and the polar regions, they are not well served by the system.
Yeah, it's because, you know, you look at the sphere,
it's hard to make the world rotate around its poles.
Yeah, and it's, you know, the Earth is not perfect sphere. There are many reasons. So that's GEO, and then came MEO, that's middle Earth orbit. I think it's middle or medium, I forget. But basically they are around somewhere between 3,100 and 7,000 miles away from Earth. And there you saw, you know, you can see with GEO 22,000 miles, latency would be a big problem of, you know, sending data up, down, so it's big latency. With this, latency is still there, but not as much, but the data speeds can go up to like 1.6 kilobits per, gigabits per second. And then you have, they complete an orbit around Earth between 2 and 8 hours, depending on where they are on the orbit. And you need 8 to 20 units to cover the Earth. And then the last one is low Earth orbit. That's where all the excitement is. So most of stuff you hear about in space tech, the satellites going up, the phone satellites, tiny satellites, they're all in LEO, which is 500 to 1,000 miles around the Earth. And they solve the latency problem. I think the speeds are really high, but they can rotate around the Earth in 40 minutes. So you need hundreds of them to cover the Earth. And the latency with them is 0.05 seconds, which is pretty good. So I think that gives you a frame of, you know, in the second section, the Earth observation and communication, why there's so much excitement.
So the LEOs essentially have a very short distance from Earth to the satellite. So the transmission time is short. And then a system like Starlink has a laser free air laser connectivity between satellites. So you can sort of go up to a satellite, communicate to a satellite beyond, mm-hmm. close to the point you're communicating with, and then a short hop back to Earth. And that's why the latency end-to-end is very low in a system like that.
Yeah, it's remember exactly, but if you're in LEO, so you have the, you know, Earth gravity is pulling you down. So the lifespan of these satellites is much lower compared to GEO, where, you know, you're up there and you're in orbit. So I don't know, they last probably for decades, but these LEO satellites you know, eventually come down to Earth and crash. I don't remember how long it takes, though. Yeah.
I think it varies from satellite to satellite, depending on sort of the fueling and the weight and these sort of things.
Yeah. There is relatively more venture funding in this space because, you know, tiny satellites or the business models are more, you can imagine, or it's higher probability than the launch business to launch satellites and create some kind of data service or image service and sell that as a SaaS to people.
Exactly. You can foresee not in an enormous investment having a dedicated data collection service for some specific use case.
Yeah. I forget the name. There are many companies doing that, and they have all different models and even different business models and what they are taking images of. But I think Internet in the Sky, oh, I should also mention Teledesic. That was Craig McCaw who created McCaw Cellular, which was the first nationwide network in the US, which AT&T bought, and now that's what AT&T Wireless is. But that also did not work for some reason. I don't know why. That was after Iridium. So there have been attempts made previously on creating Internet in the Sky, but let's hope Elon Musk succeeds.
Well, the difference between the Starlink relative to the other is that the performance is similar to not a fiber to the home connection, but it is comparable to cable connectivity or a good 4G or a bad 5G or something like that. And you cover, in principle, the whole globe. So for rural areas, it's actually a very competitive broadband connection, at least in theory. And then it's still a beta system. So, you know, but you would think they're planned for scaling this.
Yeah, I think I don't know enough, but I remember with Iridium, one of the problems was the handset cost.
And the minute cost of calling.
Yeah, and the minute cost. So for some applications, it made sense, but not to replace cellular. Because most people stay in the area where they have coverage.
Yeah.
Okay, so anything on this Earth observation and comms, Arne, before we move to the third one?
No.
The third one is robotics, which is a category in itself outside of space, but within space, I think robotics play a big role because cheaper to send robots up and maintain than people. So there are many use cases or applications of that. So space manufacturing is one. So let's say the International Space Station, they need a new part. You can manufacture it there rather than sending it from here. And there are, you know, advantages of manufacturing in space, the vacuum, et cetera, which I don't fully understand. But apparently there are things you can manufacture in space. It'll be much easier and cheaper, and new types of manufacturing would become possible. And then, of course, there's asteroid mining that it was really hot 10 years ago, but I haven't heard much about it since then. You can mine minerals from asteroids. So there also you need robotics. And of course, you need rovers, like you saw the Mars rover. So robotics is in its space. Robotics is an area in its category in itself. Yeah.
I think that's whilst I obviously agree that this is a space, I think that is a relatively more niche and special part of the industry. I think the launch business and the sort of the communication / observation business are larger existing segments for the time being.
Yeah, it's longer time horizon. I saw one of the companies that got recently funded is HIT AI. I may be mispronouncing the name, but it's GITAI, HIT AI. They're focused on space robotics. It's a Japanese startup. So I think Japan, it's ahead of in robotics in many cases. So this in space robotics, we'll see if they get a lead or what happens there. But the Mars rover, was it NASA designed or who built that? Do you know, Arne?
The space rover.
Yeah, the one.
Yeah, I believe that that was a NASA project. Yeah.
Okay. So you can see there are a lot of advantages instead of, sending people to space. If you can send robot, that's much cheaper, lasts longer, and you don't, have to have oxygen, etc. Much more difficult for people to send there. So these are the three categories we saw to think about what's happening in space in terms of investing, launch businesses. Yeah.
A couple of comments to that. I think, first of all, you pointed out, and everybody knows how much I like to place things into boxes. So I really appreciate you finding three boxes for me in space.
I
And
think for you, Arne.
exactly.
And
And
you know how much I don't like boxes.
exactly. And it's kind of counterintuitive for once I agree that space is unbounded. So, boxes for the unbounded space is kind of an interesting concept. That said, I would say that there are obviously some things that sort of fall slightly outside of the boxes, and some things that fit into these boxes. And first thing, there are strange startups that are being founded. So there's one called Relativity Space, which is about building humanity's multiplanetary future. So that's a pretty audacious startup. I don't know if I guess it fits a little bit into the robotics space that you're talking about, but it's sort of the vision of it is broader than that. I would also say that there are in the three boxes that you mentioned, there are civilian and consumer applications or business applications, but there are also defense or military national security applications for a number of these things. So that could be like, military communications or warning systems or spy satellites and this sort of thing. That is definitely so. There's lots of government money going into it for that reason, and having the high ground in is a strategic advantage. And that's why space is important in that sense. And the other saying, there's a particularly interesting category in the launch business, which is space tourism. And that's probably where there are exceptional action just these days. So there, it turns out that it becomes a little bit of a billionaire's pissing competition about being the first space tourism. So there's this speculation that Richard Branson will actually fly into space this weekend just to beat Blue Origin. And it's been well communicated that Jeff Bezos is going to space with his brother and with one or two other tourists, where there was an auction about being on that first flight, where the winner paid $28 million to go to space with a Bezos, Bezos, Jeff Bezos and his brother, and then Richard Branson is trying to steal his thunder by getting there first. So this is happening just as we speak these weeks. So an extra reason to sort of this is hitting the headlines just now.
Do you know who won the auction?
I don't know the name of the person, no.
Okay. I think the Bezos was trying to steal Elon Musk's thunder,
Absolutely.
and then Richard Branson, is getting ahead of Bezos. But what they are doing is pretty, I shouldn't say trivial, because nothing is when you go to space. They're basically going to right above outside the, you know, above Earth and coming back. So they aren't spending much time or circling around Earth at all. Or Bezos, I don't know about the Virgin flight.
The Virgin flight, I think they're, what they've set up for is sort of the whole flight is a couple of hours. And my understanding is that you go out to get to see Earth, essentially from space. So it's more about viewing it.
Yeah.
And my understanding is that you experience weightlessness for a couple of minutes on that flight. That's sort of the certainly what the test flights have done. And I think they're pretty, you know, I don't think they're going too off plan. these things tend to be tightly planned and approved.
Yeah. Okay, so these, thanks for those additions, Arne. So these are the three categories, and I think I mentioned earlier, I got the, you know, basic idea of these category from a private equity firm. And I just modified it a little bit, but basically they studied it and they're looking at it. I forget their name. If I find it, I will add that to the show notes. So now why, I thought about why is this happening now? Because, you know, we had it in the trends in 2019 and since then it's hot. So I found like the business fundamentals have changed. It's become possible now. So one of the stats I found fascinating was the space shuttle program, the cost of payload of sending, you know, 1 kilogram into space was around $55,000. And now, which is Falcon 9, which I think we talked about, that's the one that took two astronauts to the space station, the cost was around $2,700 per kilogram. So it's 20x, you know, lower almost. And the Falcon Heavy, which is another, you know, launch vehicle SpaceX has, there the cost is $1,400 per kilogram. And their plan for Starlink, I think, or Starship, I forget, whatever that is, the new one that's not completed yet, they want to get it down to $10 per kilogram. I mean, it's unbelievable. So I think the business fundamentals have changed. That's driving all the things we talked about, you know, robotics, Earth observation and communication, and launch. They only become possible because now the cost of sending things up is like 10, 20x or 50x lower than, you know, in the space shuttle program. So that's one reason. Second is China, or, you know, competition between US and China. The previous space race that produced a lot of good tech and businesses was the space race between US and Russia. And now I think China and US are competing on dominance, technology superiority, etc. I think this year China landed on the dark side of the moon, or the south side of the moon. Was it? It wasn't a manned mission. Yeah, it was a robot. Arne, you remember? Yeah, it was.
Yeah. No, it was a robot, I believe.
And I think third reason is technology evolution. So sensors are getting cheaper. The
compute is better.
What is better?
Compute. I mean the chips.
Yeah. Cost of computers better. And I think this is the stat you or somebody has quoted before. The compute power on your iPhone is higher than that was on the space shuttle or the Apollo 13.
Or it's far beyond that by now.
Yeah. So like in all areas, tech is evolving. Yeah. So that's, you can think of sensors, semiconductors, communication.
Just data analytics capabilities, both from sort of rapid feedback loops to control these things.
Yep.
You know, just think about, you know, the way that the SpaceX vehicles land now. That's very computational and heavy and needs the newest technology, but also how you use the, you know, getting massive data from space to crunch for different applications. You know, it wouldn't be possible to get those satellites up there before. It wouldn't be possible to build those satellites before, but it also wouldn't be useful to have all that data before.
Yeah, you're right. And advances in machine learning, which is also data related. So tech evolution, I think fourth is capital. So with private equity, SPACs, and billionaires, which are, you know, recent billionaires, there is capital now available where people are willing to invest a lot of money in, you know, new technology, basically new ventures with like a, you know, long time horizon for any return, if they get a return. So availability of capital is also contributing to that. And I would say the fifth reason is it's something internal. You can say it's sexy, but there's this human drive of exploration. So people, it attracts a lot of smart people or people in general. People want to go to space or explore space. So these are the main reasons I think it's happening now and what's driving it. Did I miss anything, Arne? What do you think of the logic or the reasoning?
I think it all makes sense. Last one is essentially space is cool.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's hard to, like, you know, I love it, but I cannot describe it. It's just something internal people have. A lot of people have the sense of exploration or, I don't know, being in space.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm glad we're ending on a non-box. So we did a lot of box discussion. Space is cool. We can't explain it, so it's a non-box argument. How about we end there?
Let's do it.
Okay. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
All right. Bye-bye.
See you. Bye.